Hey everyone, a quick heads up before we get to today's episode. This fall, Discovery Institute Academy will be offering both high school biology and high school chemistry for the coming school year. These high-quality online courses are designed especially for homeschool students. They cover the fundamentals of biology and chemistry, and also introduce students to the powerful evidence of intelligent design in nature. The courses include video lectures, readings, lab activities, assignments, and more. They're designed to make it easy to teach science to your kids. There are options with a live science teacher and an option that is completely self-paced. Even if you don't have kids who can participate, can you help us get the word out to those who do? For a limited time, parents who register their student can get $50 off tuition. These courses are a wonderful way to raise up the next generation of scientists. Scientists who understand that we and our universe are intelligently designed. For more information, visit discoveryinstitute.academy. That's discoveryinstitute.academy.
ID, the future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Well, have you ever stopped to think about the incredible complexity that's packed into even the tiniest forms of life? What if I told you that a single-celled bacterium manages its internal affairs with a level of precision and coordination that rivals a sophisticated factory, like turning genes on and off in perfectly timed sequences? It's a universe of intriguing and intricate machinery, all happening invisibly right around us. Well, today we're diving into the astonishing microscopic world with my guest, Dr. Jonathan McClatchy. Dr. McClatchy is a resident biologist and fellow at Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, and he's been writing extensively about what he calls recurring design logic in these complex biological systems. He argues that the way these bacterial systems are organized, with genes activating in a specific ordered manner, looks remarkably like the product of intelligent engineering. Based on his recent articles, we'll explore fascinating examples like how bacteria build their tiny motors, survive extreme conditions, and even talk to each other to coordinate the expression of toxins. So, time to buckle up for a mind-bending journey into the unseen ingenuity of the bacterial realm. Hey, Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Well, you've written recently at evolutionnews.org, our flagship news and commentary site, on examples of recurring design logic in biological systems. Now first, let's start with the basics. Tell us what you mean by recurring design logic and give us a few examples of it in everyday life.
Yeah, so throughout diverse biological systems, we often see these recurring themes or logic that pop up over and over again. And this is the sort of thing that we might expect to see in engineered systems. When we look at a building, for example, we recognize different architectural features that are associated with a particular architect. Or when we look at a painting, we see particular features that are the hallmark of that particular painter and that particular painter's work that characterize it. There are even aspects of an author's writing that are distinctive of that individual writer. So these are the sorts of phenomena that we expect to see in a designed system rather than systems that arose incrementally by chance and physical necessity.
Yeah, okay. So another word might be patterns of thinking that you would see exactly in different intelligent agents. Okay, that makes sense. Now, is the discovery of recurring design logic, even across systems that don't appear related, is that surprising or something we'd expect to see?
On the hypothesis of design, it seems to me that that is something which is really a prediction of the hypothesis, because, as I said, this is we find routinely that when we inspect engineered or designed systems, we see these recurring design themes or recurring logic that crops up over and over again. Whereas on the falsity of the design hypothesis, on a hypothesis of evolution that is unguided and mindless and devoid of teleology, it seems to me that that is something that's quite surprising, that you'd have these diverse systems which are not evolutionarily descended from one another that would exhibit the same sorts of recurring design logic that's implemented in different ways.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's jump into some examples, and you lay some out in your coverage of this particular topic. The first is something called two-component regulatory systems. Now, what are these systems? What are the two components, and what general purpose do they serve for bacteria?
Yeah, so bacterial cells use two-component systems to sense and respond to changes in the environment, and we find those throughout bacterial organisms. It is very, very common in the prokaryotic world. And as their name implies, two-component systems essentially have two major components. You have the sensor histidine kinase and a response regulator. And the sensor kinase, in response to chemical cues, undergoes autophosphorylation, which means that a phosphate group is transferred from ATP to a histidine residue on the kinase. And the histidine kinase has itself two domains. So it has an input domain and a transmitter domain. And the input domain is located on the cell's exterior, so outside of the cell. And it's particularly situated to detect incoming environmental signals. And the transmitter domain is situated on the cytoplasmic face of the cell membrane. And so it's positioned so that it can interact with the response regulator. So the phosphate group that, remember I mentioned that the histidine residue of the response, of the histidine kinase gets a phosphate group transferred to it from ATP. And then this phosphate group in turn is transferred to the response regulator. So that's the second component of the two-component system, which then drives a cellular output, such as turning genes on and off, etc. And so, as I mentioned before, two-component regulatory systems are extremely common among bacteria, and each utilizes the same basic design logic, even though these are not evolutionarily descended from one another.
Okay. All right, that's a good basic breakdown of it. So you've got a sense and response system that is common across different organisms, even wildly different organisms, as you've pointed out. Now, you give the example of E. coli regulating outer membrane proteins in response to environmental osmolarity using a two-component system like you're describing. How does this system allow the bacterium to sense changes in its surroundings and then respond appropriately?
Yeah, so osmolarity is essentially a measure of the concentration of solute particles in a solution. And the cell needs to regulate the expression of porins in response to this environmental osmoregularity. And it does so by means of a two-component system. So in this case, the sensor kinase is a protein called MZ. And it's located in the inner membrane. And MZ detects osmolarity changes, and it undergoes autophosphorylation. And then the response regulator for the system is known as OMP-R, and it receives the phosphate group from MZ, and it regulates the expression of genes. So when osmolarity is high, the kinase activity of MZ is activated, and this results in the phosphorylation of OMP-R. And when osmolarity is low, the phosphatase activity of MZ is activated, and this reduces the levels of phosphorylated OMP-R. So when OMP-R is phosphorylated, it becomes an active dimer that has enhanced DNA binding ability that's specific to OMP-C and OMP-F gene promoters. These are porin genes that encode outer membrane proteins, which allow the passage of metabolites across the outer membrane of gram-negative bacteria. Gram-negative bacteria are bacterial cells that have two membranes, an inner and outer membrane. So the pore diameter of OMP-F is larger than the pore diameter of OMP-C. So this allows for a tenfold faster diffusion rate, which is advantageous under conditions of low osmolarity, where there are scarce nutrients. If osmotic pressure is low, the synthesis of OMP-F is increased, whereas if the osmotic pressure is high, the expression of AMPC is increased, and also the transcription of MICF, antisense RNA, is initiated, and this essentially blocks the transition of AMPF by complementary binding, and that represses the synthesis of AMPF. So this is controlled by a two-component system, making use of a sensor kinase as well as a response regulator.
Okay. Yeah, and that's that's a good dose of technicality, as it were. And I always hope that, you know, the people that are listening or watching are not going to get scared away by the technical details. As Michael Behe challenges us in Darwin's Black Box, you know, we've got to bite the bullet of complexity if we want to understand why Darwinian evolution is not capable of this. So, audience, stay with us. This, you know, we really do need to get into the technical aspects of this a little bit just to understand why. So, Jonathan, I can always depend on you for that, and I'm grateful for that. Okay, so another example that you've laid out is something called chemotaxis, and that's quite a fascinating example in itself, especially the idea that bacteria have kind of a memory system for chemical concentrations. Can you explain how that system works and how it helps bacteria navigate their environment?
Sure. So chemotaxis is really a signal transduction system that enables the bacterial cell to move towards attractants like glucose or away from poisons. And it does so by modulating the frequency of runs and tumbles. So basically the flagella of the bacterial cell rotate as a bundle, and their default is to rotate in a counterclockwise way. But in response to chemical stimulus, it can switch direction and start spinning clockwise. And this results in the bacterial flagellar bundle breaking apart, and that results in the bacterial cell tumbling. Hmm. And if you are moving towards a food source like glucose, then you want long runs and less frequent tumbles so that you can move in the direction of that food source. Whereas if you're moving towards a poison or you're moving away from a food source, then you want to have frequent tumbles and shorter runs so that you can reorient yourself and sample the environment and try to get closer to that food source or away from the poison. And the chemotaxis system is, again, a two-component system. So in this case, you have embedded in the cell membrane methyl-accepting chemotaxis proteins, and different methyl-accepting chemotaxis proteins, which are also known as MCPs, can detect different types of molecules, and they're able to bind attractants or repellents. And these receptors then communicate with and activate the so-called key proteins. And so there are proteins called key A and key W, which are bound to the receptor. Key W essentially functions as an adapter protein, but key A is what we call the sensor kinase or histidine kinase for this system. And upon activation of the receptor, the conserved histidine residue of key A undergoes autophosphorylation by ATP, so it obtains a phosphate group. And there are actually two response regulators called key B and key Y. And there's a transfer of a phosphoryl group to the conserved aspartate residue from key A, right? So key B and key Y both receive a phosphate group from key A. And then the key Y protein is subsequently interacts with the flagellar switch protein that's known as fly M. And that induces the switching in flagellar direction from counterclockwise to clockwise. And so this is, again, a two-component system, which is analogous to the system that we reviewed previously on regarding osmoregulation.
Yeah, yeah. It's quite fascinating. And so the memory system then, it at least in bacteria here, in this example, it basically it's a system of chemical responses and stimuluses or stimuli based on the environment. Is that what constitutes the memory system here?
That's right. And there's, as I said, there's a second response regulator. So we've looked at QY. There's also one called QB, which, as I said, also obtains a phosphate from QA. And that in turn, that response regulator acts as a methyl esterase. So it functions to remove methyl groups from the receptor or from the methyl accepting chemotaxis protein, the MCP. And it works antagonistically with another protein called QR, which is a methyl transferase, which adds methyl residues to the MCP. And so if the level of attractant is high, the level of phosphorylation of QA, and therefore by implication or by extension QY and QB, remains low, and the cell swims smoothly, and the level of methylation of the MCPs will increase because there's no activated QB to demethylate the MCP. And the MCPs no longer respond to the attractant when they're fully methylated. So even though the level of attractant might remain high, the level of QA and level of phosphorylated QA, that is, and level of phosphorylated QB increases, and the cell begins to tumble. And the MCPs can be demethylated by the phosphorylated QB, and when that happens, the receptors can once again respond to attractants. So this regulation allows the bacterial cell to remember chemical concentrations from the recent past, a few seconds, and then compare them to those that it's currently experiencing, and thus know whether it's traveling up or down a gradient.
Okay, yeah, I think I've got it now. Well, there's something else. I mean, we think that's cool, memory system and bacteria. What about actually talking to each other? There's something called quorum sensing in bacteria. How does that allow these populations to coordinate their actions? And what are some real-world implications of this ability?
Yeah, so quorum sensing is a mechanism by which a bacterial cell is able to sample, or the bacterial population is able to sample population density. And there's a number of purposes for this. For example, if you're a lone bacterial cell, it doesn't make a lot of sense for you to start secreting poisons because it's not really going to do you a lot of good. In fact, it's going to trigger the cell's immune response. So you only want to start secreting poisons when there's when your population density exceeds a certain threshold. Or if you're a bioluminescent bacterial cell, it doesn't make a lot of sense for you to glow when there's only one of you, right? It makes more sense when there's a whole population that's exceeding a certain threshold. So each species employs quorum sensing, which includes most gram-negative bacteria. So gram-negative bacteria are bacterial cells that have two membranes. And also some gram-positive bacteria, which only have a single membrane, synthesize a tiny signal molecule that's known as an autoinducer, which diffuses freely across the cell's membrane. And autoinducers are specific to particular species, which means that each cell of the same species makes the same molecule. And this means that the autoinducer is only present in high concentrations inside the cell when there are many cells of the same species nearby. Because then if there's a certain if the population density exceeds a certain threshold, then the probability increases greatly that the autoinducers are going to re-enter the cell. And inside the cell, the autoinducer binds to an activated protein, and the activator protein is specific for that particular molecule, and thus signals the and so it signals the protein to begin transcription of particular genes. So, for example, in the case of one of the most famous, in fact, the first discovered example of quorum sensing, it was discovered by Bonnie Bassler, who's a microbiologist, is quorum sensing in vertebrate fishery, the most the kind of the model system for studying quorum sensing. And the light that this species of bacteria emits results from the action of the enzyme luciferase. So an activator protein that's called LuxR is responsible for controlling the Lux operons, as an operon is a collection of genes that are under control of a common promoter, which are in turn responsible for the transcription of the proteins required for luminescence. And these operons are induced when the concentration of the autoinducer specific to Vibrio fischeri reaches a high enough concentration. And this autoinducer is self-synthesized by the enzyme which is encoded by the LuxI gene. So quorum sensing is very widespread, particularly in gram-negative bacteria. So Pseudomonas aeruginosa, for example, uses such population sampling processes to trigger the expression of a significant number of unrelated genes when the population density reaches a certain threshold. And these genes allow the cell to form a biofilm, which increases the pathogenicity of the organism and also prevents the penetration of antibiotics. So it has wide application. But again, this system is mediated by a two-component system.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to ask, is this another example of that two-component system that you see? And indeed it is. Well, let's talk about another example of recurring design logic that you've laid out. And that's something called transcriptional hierarchies. Why is it a crucial concept in understanding how bacteria work?
Yeah, so a transcriptional hierarchy is a regulatory system in which genes are expressed in a specific ordered sequence, ensuring that the appropriate genes are activated at the right time and in the proper order. So an example of a transcriptional hierarchy would be flagellar assembly, and there's different ways that that works out. But in Salmonella, which is a model system for studying flagellar assembly, you have a defined mechanism that determines that you're not going to start producing the propeller, the filament of the flagellum, before you finish constructing the Hook basal body apparatus. And this is governed by a transcriptional hierarchy that ensures that only the appropriate genes are expressed at the appropriate time.
Now, the bacterial flagellum in Salmonella, that's an incredibly complex process. And as you say, a lot depends on how it's put together and in what order. So can you break that down in simple terms, just that assembly process and how it's regulated by these hierarchies?
Sure. So there are, in Salmonella, which as I said is the model system for studying flagellar assembly, there are three classes of genes. You have class 1 genes, class 2 genes, and class 3 genes. So class 1 genes, you've got basically two genes called FLU-D and FLU-C, and their products come together to form what's called, known as the enteric master regulator. And then that goes and drives the expression of the class 2 genes, which are comprised of 35 different genes over 8 operons. Remember, an operon is a collection of genes that are under control of a common promoter. These protein products essentially are responsible for putting together the Hook basal body apparatus. And among the class 2 genes are two genes in particular known as FLE-A, which codes for a sigma factor called sigma 28, which regulates RNA polymerase, and another gene called FLAG-M, which codes for an anti-sigma factor. So anti-sigma factors, as their name suggests, inhibit the function of sigma factors. And so as the needle complex is being completed, there is an interaction that takes place inside the needle or the type 3 secretion system, which triggers for the flag M to be exported out of the type 3 secretion system. And this then liberates sigma 28 to go and drive the expression of the class 3 genes by binding to the RNA polymerase. And so the class 3 genes code for the propeller, otherwise known as the filament, the motor force generators, chemotaxis proteins. And so that ensures the timely expression of the different sets of proteins involved in flagellar assembly. So you don't have the propeller being assembled before you've completed the Hook basal body apparatus. So it's a very elegant mechanism. And this is a prime example of what we might call a transcriptional hierarchy.
Okay. Well, moving to another example that you lay out, you discuss sporulation in Bacillus subtilis. So tell us about that and why that's important to this discussion.
Yeah, so sporulation or endophore formation is a process whereby a vegetative cell differentiates into an endospore, which is a highly resistant dormant structure that can withstand extreme stress such as heat, desiccation, UV radiation. And that process is triggered by nutrient starvation. So once sporulation has been initiated, the chromosomes align along the longitudinal axis of the cell, known as the axial filament. And the cell then divides asymmetrically near one of the poles, and that forms the smaller four spore and the larger mother cell. And the membrane of the mother cells engulfs the four spore such that it completely envelops it. And then a thick layer of heptaglycan, known as the cortex, is deposited between the four spore membranes. And this is critical for dehydration and dormancy. And physical and chemical resistance is conferred by proteinaceous layers known as spore coats, which assemble around the cortex. And then eventually the mother cell undergoes apoptosis or cell death, which releases the mature spore. Just like flagellar assembly, sporulation is under the control of a transcriptional hierarchy where you have sigma factors to promote the expression of specific sets of genes and so forth.
Okay. So another example of that hierarchy, which is very important in life, and we're seeing it across lots of different systems. Now, across all of these systems that you're mentioning, you emphasize recurring design logic. So why do you see this as surprising from an evolutionary perspective? And what does it suggest to you about the origins of these biological systems?
Right. So these systems evolved by chance and physical necessity. And bear in mind that these are not descended from one another. And it seems quite surprising that you'd get these recurring design themes ideas recur over and over again. But this is exactly what we find in not just one or two instances, but throughout biology, we see these recurring design themes, recurring design patterns, recurring design logic. And this is precisely the sort of thing that we expect to see in engineered or designed systems, but not particularly at all what we'd expect to see for evolved systems. And so it tends to support an engineering perspective on biology rather than an evolutionary one.
Right. Well, Jonathan, thanks for stopping by today to give us a little bit of that technical detail underneath this amazing class of evidence that you're identifying, this recurring design logic in living systems. Definitely another class of evidence for intelligent design in nature. So thanks for catching up with me.
Absolutely. Great to be here.
Well, audience, if you enjoyed this deep dive into the complexity and design at the heart of life, there's actually plenty more where that came from. Jonathan and I have recorded a slew of conversations unpacking numerous biological systems that exhibit evidence of intelligent design. We've done episodes on muscles, hearing, our digits, the origin of our fingers and toes, obviously, the blood clotting cascade. We did a three-part series on sexual reproduction and why that's such a spicy problem for Darwinian evolution. We've looked at the life-friendly properties of water and sunlight, and that's not even counting our chats about Bayesian reasoning and how we can apply that to a cumulative case argument for intelligent design. So lots to go back and check out if you haven't listened to those or watched them. You'll find all those episodes and many more at our website, idthefuture.com, or through your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget, ID the Future now has its own channel on YouTube. So look that up and subscribe. Help us spread the word about it. You can find it at youtube.com/@IDTheFuture. youtube.com/@IDTheFuture. Well, for the podcast, I'm Andrew McDermott. This is Dr. Jonathan McClatchy. We'll see you next time.
ID the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.